Commandment 8 tells us, you shall not steal. So we consider that commandment today. One of the things that I don't want anybody to come away thinking is that as we have unfolded the commandments, these are things that we should set before us as a way of being justified. We remember, of course, that the Lord's commandments are given to us as good and holy commandments, but that we have, as we prayed before, fallen very far short of keeping them in every way. Some might say, well, if you're going to preach on the commandments, Andy, you are inevitably going to be simply unfolding moralism. All you are doing is setting before these people the law and giving them a false expectation that they can keep it. Not at all. I set before you the law for two different purposes. Actually, three different purposes. Let's go for all three. The first is to show you that this law, as right and holy, is something that the government should be looking to as it seeks to determine what kind of laws it should pass. It should never pass laws, for instance, in regards to the Eighth Commandment, that justify stealing. God's moral law should be a rule and guide for every civil magistrate in the laws that he passes. The second thing that the law should do for us is to drive us to Jesus Christ. It should be a pedagogue that shows us how much we have in our debt, how many debts that we have to our name, and how we should be constantly seeking Christ's face, looking to him for renewing grace. And the third way, of course, is once we have obtained that renewing grace, once we have fled to Christ, it should be a rule and guide for all of our lives. And so we need to keep those things in mind, even as we look at the Eighth Commandment today. Hopefully, by the time I'm finished preaching on this, we will see all the ways. I mean, as I was going through it, I was convicted myself of ways in which I have failed to keep this commandment. Hopefully you too as well. As we go through the transgressions possible in it, we'll see all of the ways, although I doubt we will ever know all of the ways that we have transgressed it, but you will see many of the ways where you have fallen short. And this will drive you to Jesus Christ and to the grace that he gives, even to those who have broken his divine commandments. And so we now turn our attention once again to the Eighth Commandment. Now, you wouldn't think about it, you wouldn't believe it to look at them. But children, as you probably know if you're a parent, are natural barracks room lawyers. And what I mean by that is they're constantly looking for loopholes, constantly looking for ways of getting around every single command that you give them. Where's the wiggle room here, Mom and Dad? How can I get out of this? On a video, for instance, on Christian parenting that Joy and I were watching, there was a warning given by the speaker to parents who make up rules, okay, that are essentially arbitrary, that aren't founded on the law of God. But the parent thinks, oh, this is a good rule. It's a good and just rule. It'll work out in the life of their kids, not realizing that all of these rules crumble when they are put into application by these children. And this is because children will inevitably find ways that you never even dreamt of sinfully exploiting those loopholes, the wiggle room that you give them in the rules that mommy and daddy give to them. So the speaker gave the following example. He said, in their house, they had set this rule, which seems like it has a lot of sense to it. The rule is, in deciding who gets the toy when there's a fight over it, who had it first? That's the rule. Who had the toy first? That's the way we decide whether or not Child A or Child B gets the toy. So far, so good. Seems very straightforward, doesn't it? But that rule, too, crumbles when it meets the depravity of a child's heart. Very early one morning, the teacher awoke to the sound of crashing and bumping going on downstairs. And so he got up and he put on his bathrobe and he went down the stairs and he heard all of these noises coming from the children's playroom. So he went in and there he found his son, who had emptied the entire toy chest, struggling to get his hands around every single toy at the same time. Finally, he managed to do it, and he looked up at his dad with a triumphant gleam in his eye. Today, I had all the toys first. Everything was his. He found the loophole, and he exploited it. Now, is this keeping mommy and daddy's rule? Not at all. I mean, it may keep the letter, though, but it doesn't keep the spirit. And the sad thing is that the tendency to bend and twist and misuse the law, as you well know, doesn't end at childhood. It goes on in our hearts. We all have that tendency to want to try to get around the law. And I'm going to suggest to us that is nowhere more evident, nowhere more plain and clear, rather, than when it comes to the Eighth Commandment. We're always looking for loopholes, trying to figure out, well, how we can get away with something, how far we can get up to the law without breaking it. And this principle applies in spades to the ideas of stealing and theft. And I want in particular to look today at some of the ways that men and women steal from others and break this commandment, okay? Focusing not only on the obvious ways, we'll talk a little about that, but the ways where we break the commandment while simultaneously trying to convince ourselves that we aren't. That we've maybe have come up to the line, but we're not pressing beyond it. That we've done nothing wrong. That there's no obvious controlling legal authority that we've violated here. So first, let me give you the obvious ways that we break the Eighth Commandment. These are ways that, I mean, we shouldn't need to linger too far on them. You know them very well. There's, of course, ways in which we can be outright thieves, outright robbers. For instance, burglary. A man breaks into another man's home, and he steals his possessions. This is not very difficult to understand. It's a violation of the Eighth Commandment. Then secondly, there's robbery. That's when you mug someone, you take their purse or a wallet, the carjacker, the bank robber, the man who holds up the convenience store, the gas station. This is robbery. It, too, is theft. It's very easy to understand. Then we get to ways that maybe affect our hearts a little more. There's poaching or rustling. This is when someone takes livestock or wildlife from land that isn't his own and he doesn't have permission to take. So, for instance, when you hunt or you fish on land which is posted no hunting or no fishing, you are stealing. You are not only trespassing, but you are stealing what is not yours. This includes hunting out of season. It also includes taking game by illegal means, such as spotlighting or the ever-popular dynamite fishing. Both of these are thievery. You are taking game by illegal means. Then we have, of course, fourth, the dishonest servant or employee. Now, I was amazed to find out that according to crime statistics that were published, I think it was 2 years ago, this is the most common form of crime in the entire United States and the least often reported. That's when the employee helps himself to the proceeds in the cash register or who lies on his expense records or who steals company supplies or products for his own use. People are most likely, believe it or not, in the United States of America to steal from their own employers rather than people that they don't know. Fifthly, being an accomplice to outright thieves. This is also a violation of the Eighth Commandment. Now, this obviously includes the man who receives stolen goods or what he strongly suspects is stolen. If you have a good idea that something that somebody is trying to sell to you is a stolen item, should you receive it? No, because you are involving yourself in that theft. And this crime is far worse than people think. Okay? Wilhelmus of Brockel rightly pointed out, if there were no receivers or fences for stolen goods, there would be no petty thieves. If you couldn't sell the items that you were stealing, there would be no point in taking a man's television set. Eventually, you would have enough 27-inch screens in your house for even the greediest person. It is only because you can translate those goods into money and then buy things such as drugs that you want that theft continues. But being an accomplice can also include protecting a thief. Proverbs 29:24 tells us, whoever is a partner with a thief hates his own life. He swears to tell the truth but reveals nothing. And incidentally, as we are discussing this in the next commandment, to give false testimony in order to defend somebody, even if they're a relative of yours, even if they're a loved one, that is to be guilty of breaking the Ninth Commandment as well as the Eighth Commandment in the case of thievery. We should not do it. Never allow misplaced feelings of loyalty to allow you to forswear yourself in a court. It is wrong. Also, the sixth way is there is the child who robs their parents. And often children think this is not a crime, believe it or not. They feel, well, I'm family. I'm, in essence, simply coming into my inheritance a little earlier than I otherwise would. And unfortunately, parents will often turn a blind eye to this kind of theft. What do we mean by that? Well, money disappears from the aging parent's purse. But they love them, so they don't mention it. But this is not to love your child. It is not to love your child to allow them to get away with theft. Proverbs 28:24 says, whoever robs his father or his mother and says, it is no transgression, the same is a companion to a destroyer. You do not wish to put yourself or your children into that category. It is a terrible moral lesson. And if they are willing to rob from you who have nurtured them, how much more willing will they be to rob from people whom they have no allegiance to? Their employer, their friends, other people out there. It tends to snowball and go on. You are telling them the wrong lesson. So when your child robs from you, we need to address it immediately. Worse, perhaps, even than the child robbing from the parent is the guardian who defrauds the very individuals that they were supposed to protect. In the 17th century, for instance, one of the greatest fears of men of property wasn't necessarily that they would die in a childless condition and thus have no child to inherit their estate. Even worse than that was the man who died in a position where his children had not yet come into adulthood. They hadn't yet come to their maturity, and so they would have trustees over them to manage their estates. And fraud in that area was so rampant at one point that you go through the 17th century Puritan sermons and you find again and again them addressing this terrible crime, pointing out to these people what it says, for instance, in Malachi 3:5 about those who steal from widows and orphans, those who are defenseless, those who are entrusted into their protection. Malachi 3:5 says, "And I will come near you for judgment. I will be a swift witness against sorcerers, against adulterers, against perjurers, against those who exploit wage earners and widows and orphans." When you rob from a widow or an orphan or somebody entrusted into your care, you are taking advantage of the very people that you should be most zealous to safeguard. We wouldn't think that this kind of greed would be possible, but it is rampant. People taking advantage of those who have the least ability to protect themselves. Then there is the crime, eighthly, of man-stealing. Now, you may be tempted at this point to think, well, Andy, come on, you don't really need to talk to us about man-stealing or slavery. I mean, that was abolished in the 19th century, for heaven's sake. There's no more slavery. Well, yeah, outright institutionalized legal slavery was abolished in the Western world in the 18th and 19th centuries. All right, so far so good. But throughout the Islamic world, man-stealing is still very much a current practice. It abounds. For instance, the Quran specifically tells you that it is no crime to kidnap an infidel, that would be you or me, to kidnap them and then to sell them into servitude, to sell them into slavery. So this morning, for instance, I neglected to mention it, I'm very sorry for that. We had the story of Maria Samar John. You may remember this was a woman, a Pakistani woman, who was kidnapped at the age of 17, taken from her family and sold into a marriage with another man. Now, this was little more than slavery. She endured 4 years of imprisonment and torture. That was man-stealing. That is specifically condemned by the Bible. And regardless of what the Quran says about man-stealing, it is an abomination. It is an abomination regardless of who practices it. And it is a vile thing to tell people that they can go out and take others and sell them into bondage. This practice, though, brothers and sisters, is quite common with many nations, in fact, that we have, quote, normal relations with. For instance, the Sudan. Your brothers and sisters in Christ are being sold daily into slavery in a very outright way. In fact, many charitable organizations, and I think this is a misguided practice, have figured that the only way that they can end the practice of slavery is by actually buying back the slaves. Now, what's the problem with that? You get what you pay for. If slaves are profitable, you'll get more slaves, and they know it. So as we buy them out of bondage, they simply pick them up again and put them back into circulation. The only way to end that kind of thing is to end it. Even here in America, the miner who runs away from home often finds himself picked up by predators, sold into prostitution, sold into pornography. It's sometimes called the white slave trade, and it still operates here. There are many who patrol bus stations and so on and who will take advantage of runaways. This is one of the things that you should tell your children at some point, that there are predators out there who desire to steal them. Now, this kind of man-stealing, as I said, is condemned in the strongest possible terms. We see it condemned in Exodus 21:16, for instance. "He who kidnaps a man and sells him, or if he is found in his hand, shall surely be put to death." It is a capital offense in the Old Testament. And again, it is condemned by Paul in the strongest possible terms in 1 Timothy 1:10. All right, so much for the outright ways of stealing, okay, the ways that seem more obvious. Let's move on to the less obvious ways, okay? And as we do this, we're going to go from more obvious to less obvious, to a greater consensus to a less consensus on it, ways in which we are tempted to wiggle more and more. The first way is fraud. Now, this can occur when someone sells something that is either less than or of lower quality than that which the contract specifies or the agreement. Now, I've got to tell you, a lot of advertising comes either very close to fraud or is just outright fraud. We can no longer sell a product by simply saying it's a little better than the previous product. We have to say it's incredible, it's grand, it'll change your life, this is the greatest thing that you've ever had, and it's a can of beans, all right? You buy it expecting to have new friends show up at your door the next day. It doesn't happen. You are being lied to, all right? And I hope that you are gradually developing that filter that allows you to process advertising in that way, to understand that new and improved is not necessarily new or improved. But the Old Testament is full of the condemnation of the more obvious kinds of fraud. Merchants who are ripping off their customers, for instance, by using false weights. Oh yeah, that's 2 pounds of rice, when in fact your weights have been altered. So it's showing 2 pounds, but it's not really 2 pounds. And they used false measures, small ephahs, for instance, to defraud their customers. An ephah was the container that they were put into. For instance, in Proverbs 20:23, it says, "Diverse weights are an abomination to the Lord, and dishonest scales are not good." It is outright theft. But, of course, those fraudulent merchant practices didn't end simply in Israel. They go on. This was almost always rife, for instance, in government contracts, and sadly that goes on for today. During the 19th century and the 18th century, for instance, it was very common for a merchant to be contracted to deliver, for instance, to a sailing vessel, 100 barrels of salt pork. And then the ship's purser would discover that all of the barrels at the very bottom tier were rotten. But of course, he would only discover that when they were several months out at sea and couldn't really do anything about it. That became so common that they almost expected it to happen. It happened especially when the contracts were entered into for the most needy. For instance, money that was bought by the government to be given to Indians, or rather food that was bought by the government to be given to Indians, or provisions for the poor and the needy, was always expected to be of terrible quality. People were defrauding the government. This too is theft, and it's taking advantage of those least able to counter it, which is even worse. Government agents, of course, would sometimes help the merchants for a cut of the profits. This, too, is becoming an accomplice to a crime. And that thing goes on today when contractors still sell goods and services to the government or government institutions at a greatly inflated price. It is still theft. It should not be tolerated. And there is, of course, also the outright fraud of the con man. Now, if you have an email, if you've been getting email for any period of time, if you have an email account, chances are you've received email from Nigeria at some point. Mobutu Sese Seko has contacted you, informing you that he wants to use your bank account to channel $4 million of illegally derived funds. And people look at it and say, ah, all I've got to do is send them $2,000 in my bank account information, and they're going to stick $4 million or $24 million or $48 million into my account. And these things have gotten so rife that you can get Mobutu Sese Seko sending you 4 or 5 emails from different sources a day. This is a con, obviously. You are not going to receive any money. They are simply going to take what is in your bank account. Churches, in particular, have been targeted by a new and particularly horrendous form of email. It's supposedly from Muslim figures who have converted to Christianity and desire to make amends by donating to your church or institution. But the con is as old as sin, unfortunately. It has been going on. Who's the first con man? The devil in the garden. "You shall be as God!" And unfortunately, they bought it. They were conned by him. This, too, is sin. Secondly, there is the man who borrows never intending to repay, who rents and, for instance, doesn't repay on a rental contract. This, too, is wicked and sinful. Psalm 37:21 says, "The wicked borrows and does not repay, but the righteous shows mercy and gives." There are so many ways in which we can do this, so many ways in which we can, as normal borrowers, for instance, push the line by being slow in our payments habitually, for instance, having to wait until they've sent it out to collection before we actually respond. This, too, is a violation of the Eighth Commandment and something that, unfortunately, I've had to repent of myself. Now, we move on into some common but widely practiced and defended ways of stealing. The first, ever popular in the United States today, is the frivolous lawsuit. Now, there is a widely held assumption, and it is wrong and it is sinful, that if the target of your lawsuit has a lot of money, it is okay for the lawsuit itself to be frivolous. In other words, if I am pursuing an insurance company which can absorb the loss, It doesn't matter that my lawsuit is utterly groundless, that I am faking my injury and so on. This is wrong. It is still theft. It doesn't matter whether the person you are suing has $1 million or $100. The issue is not how much money that person has, but is your lawsuit right? That is the question. If your lawsuit is frivolous, if your claims are bogus, if you are lying in court, it is a sin and you are breaking the Eighth Commandment. And this constant accumulation, one person says, well, it doesn't matter the insurance company has this much money. The other person says it doesn't matter that the insurance company has this much money. The third person, and finally, you get to the point where you can drain that corporation dry, where it becomes a real problem, as it has become in the United States, for instance, with doctors being sued now to the point that many are leaving the medical field because they simply cannot afford malpractice insurance. This is theft. It is not outright. And we have men who specialize in allowing you to do this, and yet it is still theft. It is a legalized form of banditry. And so you need to take counsel. We all need to take counsel of Proverbs 3:30. Do not strive with a man without cause if he has done you no harm. If your neck really wasn't twisted in the car accident when your bumper accidentally touched their bumper. If what happened to you in the hospital was an honest mistake rather than something caused by malpractice, or if you have played up what has happened to you, this is wrong. We should not seek to defraud anybody via a lawsuit. The second way is usury. Now, this has been historically one of the most contested of the various ways of stealing amongst Reformed advocates. Usury. What is usury? Well, it's the practice, of course, of requiring a premium or interest on a loan. All right? To a certain extent, your credit cards have usury built into them. You pay interest. You are, in essence, borrowing money. And we seldom look at the credit card and think, this is a loan. But that is what it really is. Okay? You give the credit card to a merchant, and you loan money from the company that issued that credit card to pay the merchant, and then they charge you interest on it. This is the credit system, but it is a form of usury. You are paying interest on money you loan from another. Now, the Mosaic civil law allowed the practice of charging interest in regard to money loaned to Gentiles, but it did not allow the practice in regard to money loaned to believers. It felt that this was an abomination. You should not be charging your brothers and sisters in the faith interest. You should not be taking money from them that way. Now, Reformed exegetes differ on whether this is allowable. For instance, Calvin and Dabney both said in the strongest possible terms that in order to justify taking the risk and parting with money, the lender has to be able to exact some small fair premium, because there is a good chance that he will not see a repayment of all of his loans. And also, they point out that this is the only way he can stay in business, if he is exacting a small fair premium upon other people. Others have said that believers should not seek to ingratiate or engross themselves at the expense of others. They should not be attempting to make money over the backs of often the poorest people, the least able to pay for it. In fact, Wilhelmus of Brockle had nothing but contempt for one of the most common money lenders of his time, and indeed, I dare say, of our time, the pawnbroker or the pawn shop. He wrote, "To the sin of usury also belongs the activity of pawn shop operators who take all manner of securities from the poor, such as essential clothing and tools whereby they must earn a living, and who furthermore charge such excessive interest that within a short time their entire capital is gone. If thou at all take thy neighbor's raiment to pledge, thou shalt deliver it unto him. By that the sun goeth down, for that is his covering only. It is his raiment for his skin. Wherein shall he sleep?" Exodus 22:26-27. All the Reformed exegetes said that the practice of taking tools for the trade, okay, that which you need to stay alive, as collateral for a loan was wrong. So, for instance, if in the 19th century a man was a bricklayer, and he needed his bricklaying tools, you should never take them as collateral for a loan and then refuse to give them back to him, because he would starve without them. Now, what of us? What should we think of usury? Well, exorbitant interest charged on a loan merely because one can get away with it is clearly theft. All right? If you are a blood-sucking leech, let's put it in those terms, of an interest, giving, how do I want to put this, if you're charging vampiric, let's say, interest levels, this is clearly theft. And the greater the interest above normal levels, the greater the theft. Okay, Andy, so if I charge way too much interest, it's a sin. What if I charge a fair level of interest? Well, Psalm 15:5 gives us this. It says, listing qualities of the man who will ascend to God's holy hill, who is a holy man, he says, he who does not put out his money at usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. It lists usury as something that is inherently not desirable, charging interest. Others would come back and say, well, they're only talking about it in terms of not giving out loans to fellow believers and so on. But you can, you know, give a loan to somebody who is not in the faith. I think that that's pushing the line a little, especially for Christians. What would I say about this? Well, I would say that we need to be as circumspect as possible in this regard. It is not absolutely clear whether or not we can legitimately charge interest. But what we know is that we must not charge interest based upon the absolute need of this person. In other words, I know that I can charge them 35-40% because they have an incredible need and they're not going to be able to get money any other way. They have to come to me. I'm the only source in town. Therefore, I can bleed them dry. That should never be the thought of a Christian. We should never jack up the rate simply because we can. And basically, what should we be trying to do if we are people who are loaning money? We should be striving as far as possible to agree in advance to a premium and a rate of repayment that all reasonable men would regard as scrupulously fair. As Christians, we should do that. Now, why? Because the money is not ultimately important. All right? It is certainly not important enough that we would be willing to set our souls at risk or to sin against a holy God for the sake of it. Thirdly, there is a practice that used to be called engrossing of commodities, and that's the practice of buying up or monopolizing some commodity in order to enhance the price. So while you may be thinking of computer operating systems or perhaps oil or things like that, it still happens at the very basic level of day-to-day commodities, especially in storm-ravaged areas or in places where there is a natural dearth. What merchants will do is they will gather up all of the goods. They'll buy all the corn, all the grain, all the water, and therefore somebody has to come to them and pay their rates in order to have any of it. Proverbs 20:26 says, the people will curse him who withholds grain, but blessing will be on the head of him who sells it. To pick up all of a commodity in a particular area and then hold on to it and sell it at an elevated price is not only uncharitable, it is theft. It is wicked. We may make a huge fortune out of it, but that fortune, I have to tell you, will do us no good. Not ultimately. Now, let's talk about perhaps the worst kind of thief. The worst kind of thief is the church thief, or the man who steals from God. There are several ways of doing this. Okay. There's the man who withholds his tithe. Malachi 3:8 says this, will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, in what way have we robbed you? In tithes and offerings. God has been so merciful and gracious to us. And in fact, he, as we have seen, is the one who holds everything in creation. And he has given us things to be stewards of, and he blesses us abundantly. And will we respond to him by saying, I will give you nothing, or I will withhold that which is yours naturally? That is wrong, brothers and sisters. We should not withhold our tithes and offerings. Then there is, even worse than that, the pastor who does not feed his flock, but instead uses that flock as a living. Often this is a man who runs without being called. What do we mean by that? This is a man who was not called to the ministry, did not have the qualifications, perhaps even he bought his office. Or he used his influence to gain it. That still happens very frequently in the Roman Catholic Church, in the Lutheran Church, in the Episcopal Church, in places where congregations do not elect their pastors. Often influence will get a man a position when he is not suited for it. Ezekiel 34:2 says, son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, thus says the Lord God to the shepherds, woe to the shepherds of Israel who feed themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flocks? You eat the fat and clothe yourselves with the wool. You slaughter the fatlings, but you do not feed the flock. The weak you have not strengthened, nor have you healed those who were sick, nor bound up the broken, nor brought back what was driven away, nor sought what was lost. But with force and cruelty, you have ruled them. And when I read those words, I have to tell you that as a pastor, somebody called to be a shepherd, I quake. I am fearful lest I be found in that position. I would rather be worked to death, to put it quite frankly, although I'm in no danger, please, of being worked to death. But I would rather be in that state than to be ultimately condemned as somebody who sheared the flock, who was a wolf to the flock, instead of being a shepherd to the flock. Now, there are, of course, more ways to steal than I could cover, and a lack of time prevents me from going through all of them seriatim. I mean, we haven't even covered things like smuggling, tax fraud, a host of other crimes. But in the case of theft, remember this general rule, all right? If you are Christians, then you will not want to act as those children who are always seeking to find every possible loophole in your day-to-day dealings. In regard to God's commandments, you will not be as the Pharisees who looked at the technical observance of the letter as all that needed to be done and completely ignored the Spirit. Rather, if you truly love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and all your mind and your neighbor as yourself, how will you look at this commandment? Well, you will try to have business dealings that are scrupulously fair. You'll be trying to the best of your ability never to get into a position where you might be accused of thieving. And you will do all that you can to avoid any form of theft, remembering that in it you are not only offending against men, but you are also offending against God. You are breaking His holy commandments. Now, there may be some who as a result find themselves in a position saying, well, I've stolen. What should I do at this point in time? That's a good question. Wilhelmus Abrakel answered that question. He gave three answers to evasive arguments that I think are worth reading. The first evasive argument: I have stolen so much, if I had to return everything, I would be a beggar. His answer is, it's better to be a beggar than a thief. Second evasive argument: I will come to shame. Answer: there are ways whereby one can make secret restitution so that the owner receives again what is his and yet does not know from where it originates. Evasive argument number three: I'm not acquainted with those whom I have shortchanged. And then the answer: then give it to the poor, however not as an alms, that in order that you may be relieved from your debt. If you maintain that it is beyond your means to make restitution, then go to the Lord and confess your sins. May it grieve you that you cannot make restitution. Moreover, seek forgiveness in the blood of Christ. And that advice should apply to us. I know that there are probably ways in which we have stolen that have gone on so long or have receded so far in the past that we cannot even remember them. What should we do? We should seek the face of the Lord and ask for His forgiveness. And not only that, but seek His strength not to continue on in it. There are so many ways in which we can fail to be scrupulous in our business dealings. There are so many ways in which we can defraud men even without thinking about it. So many ways that we can take advantage of parents, friends, loved ones. We should be scrupulous to avoid that. More than just simply seeking to avoid to steal from people, to be thieves, we should be generous. We should be merciful. We should be looking for ways in which we can benefit all those who are around us. Let us remember that we have a Lord who died and in so doing forgave the thief to his left.